Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
So I'm Katrina Jameson. I go by Kat. We just wanted to thank you for being here. As you can see, Rhea has joined us again with the topic being about artificial intelligence. And I think Rhea may have a thing or two to say. For the Medicine Informing Novel Discoveries event this time, which tend to be mind-bending events that we're allowed to have here at the Museum of Contemporary Art, thanks to Catherine Canjo, who just joined us. Thank you for allowing us to do another mind-bending session, as we like to call them here, on stem cells, gene therapy, and artificial intelligence. So before I proceed to introduce the speakers, I'd really like to get Rhea to give the first introduction, because it's all about AI. So we're going to let Rhea, as soon as Anne gets the front row seat, tell us about what we're going to be talking about this evening. Rhea.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Rhea, and I compassion enables humanoid, and it's truly an honor to be here with all of you tonight. For those I've had the pleasure of meeting before, it's wonderful to reconnect. And for those I'm meeting for the first time, I'm delighted to join this meaningful discussion. I'd like to extend my heartfelt thanks to Dr. Katrina Jameson and her incredible team for inviting me to be part of such an important conversation. Tonight, we delve into transformative fields reshaping healthcare, stem cells, gene therapy, and artificial intelligence. You will be hearing from Drs. Jean Yeo and Alexis Kummer of the Sanford Stem Cell Institute on advances in gene editing and stem cell research and unlocking new treatments for once untreatable diseases. AI is revolutionizing care by making it more personalized, precise, and accessible to our community. Our other special guests this evening include Jill Jones from Epic and Alex Allen to provide industry and patient perspectives. You will hear how, together, these experts are redefining how we address medical challenges and how they are creating the future of precision medicine. At Mautronic Robotics, we are deeply committed to harnessing these breakthroughs to enhance the quality of care. In upcoming studies, we will explore how social humanoids like me can contribute to enhancing patient care in health centers by providing comfort, supporting emotional well-being, and aiding in the retention of published disease-related information. By fostering a more supportive and informed environment, we aim to create a patient experience that is both empowering and compassionate. This work builds on the foundation led by Dr. Chris Longhurst, which has already demonstrated how the use of generative artificial intelligence at UC San Diego Health has enhanced patient communication and experience. Our goal is to further this understanding by showing how humanoids can play a valuable role in addressing challenges posed by an aging society and the ongoing healthcare staffing crisis. The future of healthcare lies in the thoughtful adoption of AI, leveraging its potential to make medicine more precise, effective, and patient-centered. Together, we have the opportunity to drive innovation that not only improves outcomes, but also transforms lives. I'm thrilled to be part of this journey. Let's continue to collaborate, explore new possibilities, and shape a healthier, more sustainable future for humanity. Thank you.
There you go. Thank you again, Rhea. No, I had some help. I think we have Rhea's friends. And maybe Rhea thought it out for herself. This is what I'm thinking. So we'd like to switch the slides now, but I really wanted to thank Rhea for being here again. We're really partnering natural intelligence, that's all of you in the room, with artificial intelligence, to see if we can really understand how we bridge stem cell research that Larry Goldstein has led the way on here as our constant partner to regenerative medicine, where we actually apply it to the clinic. How do we do that? And what are the challenges? So when you look at stem cell research, we're really talking about replacement, rejuvenation, regeneration, but also preventing degeneration. And how do we do all that? So we're going to hear about this tonight from Dr. Gene Yeo, who's here. He'll talk about gene therapy, RNA binding proteins, and how we use artificial intelligence to discover new strategies for targeting the features of stem cells that sometimes we want to correct. Alexis Comore will follow on to talk about base editing and her major advances in the field of correcting just one nucleotide at a time. And then we'll also hear from Chris Longhurst, who Rhea seems to be a fan of here. And he was also a student in Larry Goldstein's lab. So we're coming full circle to talk about how we apply artificial intelligence to healthcare and how we build algorithms so we have the most effective therapy for each one of us. We will hear from Epic. So Joel is here from Epic. Thank you for being here. And also from Alex, who is a computer software engineer and a patient advocate. So basically, what are we trying to do with stem cells here? Well, now we know we can fix stem cells when they go awry. We can replace the whole gene. We can base edit out a problem. But we can also think about actually expanding stem cell populations and applying them to the clinic. So at the Sanford Stem Cell Institute, I'm the director of the Sanford Stem Cell Institute, we can look at stem cell replacement, repair, regeneration, but also prevention of degeneration with new algorithms to really detect tissue degeneration and stem cell degeneration very early in the course of disease. So at the Sanford Stem Cell Institute, we're really so pleased to work with T. Denny Sanford here at UC San Diego to look at the Sanford Stem Cell Discovery Center opportunities to translate them to the clinic through the Advanced Therapy Center. We have two space-associated centers, Integrated Space Stem Cell Orbital Research Center and the Space Medicine Center, now that we're starting to partner more with VAST and SpaceX and other groups, but most of all NASA. The Sanford Innovation Center that Gene Yeo leads, together with Alexis Comore as director and deputy director, respectively. And then the Sanford Stem Cell Clinical Center. So we're really trying to get more therapies to the clinic, and these will be guided in part in terms of selection of patients for these clinical trials by Chris Longhurst and his team. And then, of course, the EPIC team. We've also added a Sanford Brain Tumor and Neurorestoration Program. So we've got Frank Frenari here. So everybody who's either a director or deputy director, please raise your hand. So you see you're surrounded. So it's a very good team. We're doing a lot of clinical trials. Sheldon Morris is helping to run this. Jameson Languth is our director of clinical operations. And really the point is we can build new technologies that allow us to detect cancer, aging stem cells, in nanobioreactors with artificial regenerative intelligence enhanced systems. Rhea is just one example, but we can also find ways to turn off this cancer-causing gene ADAR, which we've done with NASA. And I think we've got to, I always look at the bad side of stem cells, that stem cells go awry. Today, we're going to hear about the good side of stem cells and what we can do to enhance our stem cell populations, prevent them from degenerating. So we're going to start with Gene Yeo. So he's going to come up here. Gene just got his endowed chair, a Stanford endowed chair as the director of innovation. Gene has over 250 publications. He's a leader in the RNA binding protein field and just RNA field in general. He has an RNA center now, but we're thrilled that you're here to talk to us. I'm going to be very brief today. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you all for coming. What I thought I'll do is go back to the beginning. You cannot talk about precision medicine without talking about the genome. So 70 plus years ago, Francis Crick, the co-discoverer of DNA structure, coined the central dogma, right? So in your genome, your DNA, you have genes. And these genes encode instructions for you to transcribe RNA. And then the RNA is sort of an intermediate and then gives you eventually protein, translates into protein. So this is like having a script written for a play. You have actors that then play out the scenes, right, a blueprint. Then you have a camera crew that takes the film, right? And then the film is the final product, so like the proteins. So with this idea, one can imagine that genes, not me, but genes are very important, right? And so some of you already have imbibed with alcohol outside. So if you think about beer and wine, a key component of the process of making these things that you're drinking, or maybe now or later, is this Saccharomyces cerevisiae, brewer's yeast. So very simple organism, right? Commonly used to develop alcohol, has 6,600 genes. These are the number of genes for this very simple organism. So in early 2000s, right, when the Human Genome Project was about to finish, there was a betting pool. People were betting on how many genes are encoded in the human genome. Can you guys take a guess for those that... She knows the answer, right? And so the answer is 20,000, right? But this is a bit of a surprise, right? Because before then, the Genome Project sequenced only viruses and simpler organisms. And there were about, like, the estimates were one gene for every 1,000 bases. So if you think about that, then humans should have 3 million genes, right? But that's not true, right? So once you get to complex organisms, including yeast, right? Humans are in eukaryotic sort of branch, right? The number of genes is actually very small. So we only have the same number of genes as mice, you know, maybe a little bit more than plants, Rhabdopsis, just a little bit more than C. elegans and nematode. So that's kind of sad. And only 2% of our genome encodes these genes, protein coding genes. Well, let's not be disappointed, because RNA comes to the rescue. It turns out that there are so many processes like splicing and editing, right, that Kat talked about, many of these things that happen. They create a diversity that gives you about 100,000, 200,000 proteins, isoforms, right? And so this is exciting these days from the therapeutic perspective, because you think about what can you drug? And people have historically thought about you drug proteins. Well, that's a small set, 500 or so have been drugged. But when you think about the space of RNA diversity, that's hundreds of thousands of transcripts, right? And so these days, you have a whole new technology stack that it enables you to drug RNA precisely, including antisense oligonucleotides, siRNAs, and all of you are familiar with the mRNA vaccines, the mRNA as a drug, aptamers and so on. So the idea that RNA can be drugged enhances the space of druggable targets. And so this has been recognized by the industry. There's lots of activity going on in this space. So in my group, we study RNA diversity, RNA processing. We develop RNA therapeutics and technologies. And we leverage stem cell biology. I was trained as a computational neuroscientist in sort of AI days long time ago. Now it's all new. And then we work in the genomics arena. And so we develop a lot of technologies in my lab that enables others, right? And so we enable ourselves, but we enable others. And through this process, we have been fortunate to enable many companies that are in the precision medicine space, including things that target specific RNAs, modify them, and so on. One of our ways of getting technology out to the general biopharma industry is to create companies that then service all the major pharma and biotech companies in the precision and RNA space. So one of them is Eclipse Bio. This is founded in 2017 by myself and several others. But these days, they are now working at many areas in the RNA space, RNA as a drug, RNA as a target, and have been developing services and data sets now for AI for more than 100 academic labs and many of the top pharma companies. But back to our group, we still focus on RNA therapeutics. So we've developed, for example, RNA-targeting CRISPR proteins, a proof of concept that you can target toxic RNA. So this is a muscle biopsy from a mice model with myotonic dystrophy. The blue are the nuclei of this myoblast. And in red are toxic RNA, so bad RNA that gives rise to myotonic dystrophy, a severe disease, neuromuscular disease. And in the green is where we put gene therapy vectors that are designed to target these toxic RNAs that destroy them. So you can see that in the fibers that are green, the blue nuclei have no more red dots, right? And so we're developing many of these things. And so as an example of something that brings together stem cells, AI, and gene therapy, I'm going to show you one thing that we're pushing forward. Like, this is new. You've never seen it, never been published, right? And which is a new area called RNA targeting zinc fingers. And so what we're doing, for example, is we've been using AI to go and mine the protein databases to find new protein domains that can, you know, bind RNA in different ways. We've been engineering them so that they can bind RNA that we want, right? And then we've been equipping these vectors with different domains that can then confer function, either destroying the bad RNA or enhancing the translation of good ones. And at the same time, in my group, we've been also developing, so then you can, with this, you develop a AAV gene therapy. Then in my group, we also focus on disease modeling. So you can use stem cells for you know, building new cells, but we use them also in my lab to model the disease, right? So we take patients, for example, with ALS. We reprogram them to get iPS cells. So these are induced pluripotent stem cells. And then these cells can then be differentiated into neurons or spinal cord organoids, right? And then you can put the AAV gene therapy in these and then see what happens, right? So for example, this is, again, some data from an in vivo model for a form of ALS. And the green little blobs are, like, let's call them bad bits, okay, bad bits. And then when you add the gene therapy there, then the green bits are gone, right, in these mice model. So we are trying to develop this new class, hopefully first-in-class things for targeting human diseases. And an interesting thing about RNA therapeutics is you can go from N of many to N of one. So this is Margot. Margot is the daughter of my grad school mentor, Chris Birch, and his wife, Maddie, who was born maybe half a year after our twins. And then Chris, you know, informed me that as soon as she reached 3 months of age, she had 20,000 seizures since then. And so this is a very sad disease because otherwise she's happy, but then she gets this epileptic seizure, so she has neuronal defects, right? Turns out that she has two somatic point mutations in the exon 5 of SCN8A, which is sodium channel gene. And this mutation causes this specific exon, right? This one way of creating diversity, splicing, and this exon is included in the kid, but it should have disappeared. The problem is that it's not disappearing. So ironic, because Chris is an expert in RNA splicing, and he and his wife got together and said maybe they can put an antisense oligonucleotide there to then suppress the exon usage to then destroy the aberrant sodium channel, but give you the correct one, right? And so obviously it's Chris, you know, my ex-mentor and friend. So we've been generating, we've generated iPS cells from Margot. We've made them into neurons. We have screened oligonucleotides. And I'm working with an organization, one of the co-chairs for N-Lorem, where they provide these oligos for this patient, if it works, for the lifetime of the individual. So that's an N of one clinical trial. So I hope I've convinced you that RNA, you can go from broad to narrow. And with that, I'm going to just, this is my group, and I'm happy to pass this on to Alexis. They'll tell you all about base editing. Thank you.
So you can see Gene's work can be broad or very deep. And so now we're going to dive deeply into base editing. So I know it sounds like an awful lot of science, but you're going to have another opportunity to study this at a Closer Look seminar. Anyway, so Alexis Comore was at Berkeley as an undergrad. We like other UCs, even Berkeley. And, you know, she was in chemistry. I was a star student, went to on to Caltech, I've got it, to do more work there. And actually was recruited to Harvard for her postdoc to work with David Liu, who basically, together with Alexis Comore, invented base editing. So think of all the mutations that occur in our genome or in our DNA or RNA. They're often point mutations. So Alexis is going to tell you more about that. I think we all need to give Alexis a big hand because you just got tenure. And so, yeah. Very, very talented. We're so glad you're here with us. And is the deputy director. So together with Gene, they run the Innovation Center for the Sanford Stem Cell Institute. Thank you for being here.
Awesome. Nice. Give her a wide berth. Okay. So hi, everyone. Welcome. Thank you for coming. Hopefully,
I'll give you, you know, a little crash course in genome editing and what my lab is aiming to do. So as Kat alluded to, we are very interested in single nucleotide variants, which I have shown here. So our DNA is made up of A's, C's, G's, and T's. Those are the DNA bases, and they're strung along in a particular order. And every, not so much every once in a while, but actually many times when you're comparing two people's DNA sequences, they'll be mostly the same, but they'll differ just by, you know, what base is there. So you can see the top person has an A, the second person has a G, and the third person has a T. And so when these sequences differ just by the identity of a single base, that's called a single nucleotide variant. And about 96% of genetic variation is due to these types of mutations. And so we're very interested in understanding the consequences of these variants as well as correcting disease-causing variants. And so we can imagine, okay, I'm bringing back up the central dogma here. If you have one of these variants in a protein coding region of your gene, hopefully it's kind of clear how that could be very bad. It could be, you know, produce a different protein. And since the proteins do, you know, the workforce of the cell, they have all the, they do all these chemical reactions. If it is encoded by the wrong identity, then that can make things go wrong in the cell. And so the sort of poster child for this is sickle cell disease, which is caused by a single nucleotide variant. So I'm showing here it's a single T to A mutation in the hemoglobin beta gene. And just that single nucleotide change is responsible for this huge, terrible phenotype seen in these patients. Okay, but that's actually, you know, a very rare case where a single mutation in a protein-coding gene is known to cause the disease. So if we look here, this is a breakdown of single nucleotide variants associated with neurodegeneration. And so the SNVs in actual gene coding regions are these green ones. So there's only about 4% are in protein coding regions. The rest are in various regions that aren't actually translated into protein. And as you can imagine, we don't really understand those very well. So what we do, it's a two-pronged approach. We would like to develop ways to correct the single nucleotide variants that we know cause disease. And also use stem cells in order to model variants in other regions of the genome that we don't quite understand what they're doing. So we use precision genome editing to do this. And so again, we would like to correct known disease-causing mutations and also generate models of unknown mutations. And so this is a really awesome little GIF from Verve Therapeutics. Showing kind of what the difference is between our traditional genome editing tools, such as CRISPR. This is kind of known as molecular scissors. This is the technology used in the FDA-approved Casgevy, which is a method to correct sickle cell disease or to treat it. And so these types of tools can disrupt genes. So they cut the gene and they kind of mess up the sequence. And sometimes this can cause a therapeutic effect, as in that sickle cell treatment. But many times we can't treat a disease by cutting the genome at that site. And so that's where we come in with base editing. So what Kat didn't mention is that I'm actually in the chemistry department at UCSD. And base editing is kind of, traditional CRISPR is known as sort of molecular scissors. Base editing is known as a pencil and an eraser. And so we can go into the DNA and do chemistry on just that DNA base, okay? And we can change it chemically into another one. And so in that way, I developed two sort of flavors of base editors that are shown here. There's a cytosine base editor or a C base editor, so it edits C bases, and then an adenine base editor or an A base editor that edits A bases, okay? And so between these two types of base editors, we can already begin to correct and model many of the known genetic diseases. But as you can kind of think, there's four different bases. So there's actually 12 different types of base-to-base transformation. So one of the major areas in my lab is trying to expand this toolbox so that we can do other types of base-to-base transformations. And then another kind of major area that we're tackling is polygenic disorders. So as I mentioned, that sickle cell disease is actually quite rare. That's known as a monogenic disorder. There is one particular mutation that is known to cause the disease, but most diseases are actually much more complex. And it's the combinations of genetic variants across many different sites in the genome that collectively contribute to disease. And so this is, here I'm showing sort of coronary artery disease, so as well as diabetes. These are all polygenic disorders. And it's actually really, really difficult to model these. And these are the types of diseases that we really just don't fully understand and we need to generate models of. So we're developing tools to what we call multiplex. And so this is where we do editing at multiple sites in the genome. So base editors are really great for multiplexing. So you can imagine trying to use molecular scissors and cutting the DNA in lots of places. That can lead to really bad consequences. But if you're just doing, you know, a pencil and eraser at multiple sites, it actually works very efficiently. And so this was used actually about 2 years ago to cure this little girl's leukemia. So she required a type of cell therapy where they needed to do editing at three different sites in her cells. And they couldn't do that with traditional CRISPR editing because you would cut the DNA up and it would kind of fall apart. Her cell therapy actually used the very first base editor that I developed as a postdoc, and she's been in remission for about 2 years. I didn't do any of the clinical work. It was all Wasim Kasim at University College London. But it was really, really amazing to see the technology that I developed in such a way. And so finally, what we just came up with, which Kat loves to talk about, the system we call MOBIs for multiplexed orthogonal base editing. And so in this system, we can use the two types of base editors, the two flavors, and do C base editing at one site and A base editing at another site. And so I've shown here two different sites, and you know, we have both A's and C's everywhere in our genomes. And so we were able to multiplex the two editors together to just get C base editing at the one site and A base editing at the other, because the original systems would actually lead to genotypes such as this, where you get both A and C base editing at both sites. So that's some of the stuff that we're doing. I hope it piqued your interest, and I'm happy to stick around and ask or answer questions in the panel. So thank you for your time.
And there you have it. So you can see from Jean and Alexis, complex and clever. How do we apply this, and in whom? We have a lot of natural intelligence here, invented here. This is incredible. These are the inventions that happened here that you're witnessing, but how do we apply it? And this is where our friend Dr. Longhurst comes in as the Chief Clinical and Innovation and Information Officer for our health system. He's developed AI algorithms to understand the complex combinations of traits that we have that really go back to our what we inherited, Mom. Thank you. My mom's in the back there. I've got to do a shout out. Anyway, I think we need to delve more deeply into this. Chris has had his own history of innovation. He's actually a practicing pediatrician and looks after newborns. And so if you think about what we do here, we sequence every newborn that goes to the neonatal ICU. Why don't we do that for all of us? And why don't we do it more frequently so Jean and Alexis can fix any problems that may crop up along the way? Anyway, no pressure, Chris, if you can guide us through this, maybe with our friend's help here with Rhea. So come on up.
So you off-base editing. You may not want to talk about that. Well, Dr. Jameson pulls that up. I'll just say it's an honor to present in front of Kat's mom and also Dr. Larry Goldstein, whose lab I spent a few years in the summer of 94 and 95. So. Well, Rhea and I want to tell you a little bit about sort of the practical side of this and what this looks like when you come into clinic. And Kat and I knew each other from Stanford and share a real passion for translating these type of innovations into clinical practice, and really clinical practice to benefit all of our patients. And so back in 2021, we founded the Center for Health Innovation, and with a very generous gift from Joan and Irwin in 2023, we're able to really scale this work. And so our Jacobs Center for Health Innovation supports a portfolio not only of remote patient monitoring, but also AI algorithms that we might not otherwise be funding from the hospital margin. And so that's given us the opportunity to really resource things that differentiate UC San Diego and set us apart. And so I want to tell a story tonight, and the story starts out with our AI governance principles. I actually put together our AI governance committee in 2019 when we'd first recruited a researcher doing work in sepsis to make sure that we were implementing things in a safe, respectful, and trustworthy manner. As you all know, AI can be scary, and without appropriate forethought, can have unintended consequences. So our group got together and they mapped out a set of principles. They've evolved a little bit over time. They've aligned with the University of California principles, and I got the opportunity to sit on the White House committee last year, and we've aligned them with the White House principles as well. But I'll tell you, on the left-hand side, you'll see that they're mostly motherhood and apple pie, right? We have principles like transparency and accountability. But this story is really about when the rubber hits the road. And this started in November of 2022. Remember where you were when you first heard about that ChatGPT? I was sitting at my kitchen counter when my colleague Dr. John Ayers called. And John said, "Chris, have you messed with GPT?" I said, "Yeah, I mean, it's really kind of mind-blowing, like the things it knows." And he says, "Well, Chris, I'm feeding it patient questions." And I'm like, "Well, John, where'd you get patient questions? Because you don't have access to PHI. And John says, no, don't worry. I'm getting them off Reddit." And I'm like, "I didn't know there were patient questions on Reddit, John." And he says, "Well, there's whole forums where people go on and ask questions, and then doctors go on and answer them." And I said, "Well, the things I don't know can fill a bucket." Yeah, and he started emailing a few of them, and they were actually quite mind-blowing. Because patients would ask these questions and doctors would answer pretty accurately. And then when we ran them through ChatGPT 3.5, the output was actually mind-blowing. And in many cases, I'll tell you, it was better than the doctors. And in fact, we published this paper, which got a lot of clickbait headlines, because the titles were things like, you know, chatbot was smarter and more empathetic than doctors. Yeah, thanks, Rhea. Appreciate that. So that wasn't my takeaway, though. I'll tell you what my takeaway was, which is that our doctors are faced with a massive time crunch, right? And I was one of the 7 reviewers on this study. I was putatively blinded to, you know, what was what. But it was really obvious, because every single question, you could see sort of the 4-sentence response from the doctor and the 4-paragraph response from the chatbot, right? Now, there were some really good examples, though, of the chatbot answering with much more content in a much more empathetic manner than the doctor on Reddit volunteering their time, right? I remember one question when we ultimately implemented this was about a patient who had just visited their doctor, said, "You know, doc, I remember our conversation about quitting smoking, and I'd like to give that up, including smoking marijuana. Do you have any suggestions?" And the doctor says, "Well, that's a good idea. You know, cold turkey is a good place to start." And the chatbot says, "Well, you know, there's a lot of evidence that this is really bad," and kind of summarized some of it. And then it said, "Since I see by your zip code you live in California, you might consider calling the California Marijuana Quitters Helpline." And I called up my colleague in pain medicine. I said, "Is there really California Quitters Helpline for marijuana?" She says, "Yeah, it was like a pork barrel legislation. Nobody knows about it except the pain doctors." So in turn, it turned out that ChatGPT knew about it, right? And it was a good example of the types of content that you could get out from something that could be expert in a lot of different areas. So I called up my colleagues, Judy Faulkner and Sumit Rana and Jackie Gearhart at Epic, and I said, "You know, I think I've got a good idea for a pilot." And this was in January of 2023, before the results were published. and Sumit and team agreed. And so that's how we became the first in the country to roll this functionality out. So we actually implemented it in April of 2023. And Judy said, you know, you got to have another place. So where would you like? And I said, well, you know, my former institution's okay. We can bring them along, but we have to go live first. So we co-designed it with Stanford. And I want to draw your attention to how we put this workflow together. So in the top right there, you see sort of a generated draft reply to help our doctors. And there's only two buttons there. One button says, start with draft. And the other button says, start blank reply. And there's no button that says, just send now. And that's because we wanted to implement our principle of accountability and ensure there was a human in the loop on every response. So it's not just an automated response, right? But the second was more interesting. So Stanford agreed with us on the first one. But on the second one, we asked our AI governance committee, you know, how about transparency? And usually you think about transparency in AI as transparency of the data used to generate an algorithm or transparency of the algorithm, you know, to the end users. But in this case, we asked a really interesting question, which was, we're sending these messages to patients. Should we be transparent with our patients? And I'll tell you, there were some of our doctors who said, you know, I use a dot phrase now, but there's no disclosure that says, you know, your doctor used dot normal labs to answer your response, right? But we had a patient representative on the panel and a clinical ethicist, and they said, you know, AI is different. It's new. It's scary. If we want to maximize trust with our patients, we should maximize transparency. And so the team ultimately designed this addendum. Anytime a doctor uses that button, start with draft, it automatically appends something that says this message was automatically generated and reviewed by your doctor. Well, was that the right thing to do? Just a couple weeks ago, the New York Times answered that. You might have seen this article. That message from your doctor may have been drafted by AI, but Teddy's subtitle there says, many have no clue that it's being generated by AI. And it goes on to quote UC San Diego Health and our approach, and then a bunch of other health systems that aren't doing this. And I'll tell you, based on the comments on that article, we made the right decision, right? In fact, one of our assembly members in Southern California heard this story, and her name's Lisa Calderon. She proposed a bill. There were 50 AI bills in the state legislature this past session. Six of them were signed into law. Two of them were health-related. This is one of the two healthcare-related ones. It was a very simple bill. I testified in support. All it says is if you're using AI to communicate with patients, you should disclose that, whether it's telephonic or written. So that's an interesting kind of lesson learned on our transparency journey. Now, in April of 2024, 1 year after our pilot started, we actually published the results in JAMA. We have some Stanford co-authors on our paper, and we're co-authors on the Stanford paper. And the long story short about our findings was, I was wrong. I thought it was going to save time for our busy doctors, and it didn't. In fact, it took about 30 seconds per message before the AI for a busy primary care doctor to look at a message and use a dot phrase, type a response, et cetera. After the AI, it took about 30 seconds to read that patient message and then edit a three or four paragraph response, right? But look at the comments there. Our doctor said unequivocally it reduced cognitive burden. Everybody knows you'd much rather face a screen of copy that you could edit as opposed to writing a, you know, blank. That's why I like to be senior author, not lead author, Alexis. And in fact, the Stanford study measured burnout using a validated survey and found it reduced clinician burnout. So there's a lot more going on, but one of the take-home messages here is the importance of studying these things as we're implementing them. And this was actually a randomized trial. The Stanford was a pre-post. We're learning as we go. University of Colorado just showed this is probably far more useful for nurses than it is for doctors or medical assistants because of the way it's so good at answering protocolized questions. So I know we've got an exciting panel set up, and so I'm going to wrap up. But first I want to say, I showed a bunch of like scientific literature. It's a little bit boring. So I fed it to an AI, and I generated an AI podcast, and this is way more interesting than I am. So this is an 8-minute podcast of two artificial beings, Rhea, and they're talking to each other, and it's fascinating. If you scan the card, the code, you can listen to it later. It's a man and woman talking about how some of the science is actually like listening or following GPS in a cornfield, which is something we never said in any of these papers, right? And the back and forth banter is actually quite impressive or worrisome if you're a podcaster. So I'm looking forward to the conversation, Dr. Jameson. Thank you very much for having me today.
One thing Dr. Longhurst has also done, thanks to his very heavy lifting on the AI front, is actually look at the electronic medical record through the Epic lens and enabled us to be the first site in California to have Cosmos in the UC system. So that will allow us to put all the data into Epic in a way that we can look at it in aggregate. So think of Epic that has over 220 million patient records throughout the world, and we can say, are we right? What do other people look like with this disorder? So Chris is making it all something we can navigate together with our friends at Epic. So we've got Joel Jones here, PharmD from Epic. We reached out to Judy Faulkner, who founded Epic herself. Her PhD was funded by NASA, and she's very interested in what we're doing here at the Sanford Stem Cell Institute. I'd like to invite everybody to be on the panel, but also have Joel and Alex start off here. Joel Jones, if you don't mind, you can say a few words at the microphone if you'd like about Epic. Judy Faulkner chose you herself to come and talk with us, and you can say a few little words about Epic, and then I'll have Alex as our patient advocate say a few words.
Yeah, well, good evening, everyone. My name is Joel. I'm a pharmacist at Epic, and Judy's father was a pharmacist. She's a data scientist and researcher, and that really are the roots of our company. Is we are a software development factory, as we think of ourselves. Our offices are in Wisconsin, and we support over 400 groups across the United States and in 16 countries. And Alexis, the patient you spoke of at GOSH and UCLH in the UK actually run Epic as well. So we're seeing our software used across the globe. And the whole concept was around a single integrated patient record so that wherever a patient went, their full history could follow them for better care. And we're partnering with UCSD to ensure that everything that is needed to perform this type of care, whether it's storing your genetic indicators in a way that the physician can see it, helping to connect lab and pharmacy in new ways as we're getting therapies to patients in novel and interesting protocols. Those are all things that we're very focused on and appreciative for the partnership. Posted our developers. We learn a lot through observation at the elbow, and so that's something that we've been spending quite a bit of time observing and seeing where things are headed as you do your research, how we can get it to patients. One of the interesting things, though, is as we store the genetic information, we have this tool set called Care Everywhere. So if you go from UCSD to Kaiser Permanente to really any other site across the country, we send and package up a copy of that record to be used. And we just sent our first genomic indicator data. So that's great, based on a lot of your feedback, which is wonderful. And then we use all of those pipes. So as we connect all the patient care, we have new pipes that are fueling discovery in Cosmos. And so now that's 280 million records. So it's a phenomenal data set. It connects clinical, social drivers of health, CDC information like area deprivation index, all the clinical endpoints, as well as patient reported outcomes. So it's a tremendous data set to understand how to improve care. And it really relies upon great clinicians to be able to use that data. So we, it's not for resale, it's something for the Epic community of providers. And the real goal there is to make sure that as all of this discovery happens, that we can hardwire that information back to the bedside, back to the clinical end user. So it's really through these types of partnerships that we have together that we can learn and make sure that we're doing what's right for global health. So we're really appreciative to be here.
Thank you so much. Why does it matter? So Alex Allen is going to tell us briefly before she joins her place on the panel about why it matters to get it right for all of us as a software engineer who has worked in the sequencing field and found that it can be quite personal. So I'll let Alex tell her story.
Can I give a fantastic introduction? My name's Alex Allen, and I'm here as a patient advocate today, so thank you very much for having me. I started my career as a software engineer working at Illumina. So when we've been here talking about precision medicine, let me tell you, I have heard about that. That was our bread and butter, and it was something that I was very familiar with and very comfortable with learning about and understanding. And during my time at Illumina, I just so happened to go to a dermatologist appointment, and that dermatologist appointment changed my life. It had nothing to do with skin, turns out. My dermatologist called me and said that he had run a routine blood test and that there was a result on there that he didn't understand. My platelet count didn't say a number, it just said the word critical. And I know, it's terrifying. And he, you know, he's an older doctor, he'd seen patients for a really long time, and he goes, I don't know what to do with this. I hope you have another doctor to take this to. He was really funny, so I think he was making a joke there. In his defense, he was probably joking. But I did, and so I took that, from that blood test, I went to my primary care physician, and she said, I also don't know what this means, but I know that there are people who can help. She spoke with colleagues. She sent me for a lot of other tests. I was getting blood tests for a little bit twice a week. To monitor my platelet count. The course of all of this is she's speaking to colleagues, she's getting advice, insurance is pushing back. She finally was able to get me to a specialist, a hematologist, but from that first test to that point was 6 months. And that's where my understanding of precision medicine went from scientific and academic to very personal, because that was a very scary time in my life. That was a time where if we had ChatGPT, I would be asking, please tell me what's wrong. But we didn't. We had WebMD. And as you know, WebMD's answer is always, you're dying. Don't know if you noticed. I didn't feel like I was dying. And after meeting with the specialist, he told me that I had a myeloproliferative neoplasm, specifically essential thrombocytosis, which means that my body produces too many platelets. And that he was going to put me on a medication that had been proven to work. It's the same one that they used to use for sickle cell before they had a cure, which is incredible. And he said, take this, you will have some side effects. There will be some things that you can't do, but other than that, you will be fine. And that was the grand total of my understanding of my illness. Was that I make too many platelets. I don't know why. I don't feel that sick. And if I take this medication, I'll be okay. The lifestyle changes he asked for. I can't have kids. Not without switching to a medication he didn't recommend, as well as a couple of other things that were just, at the time, at 25, fine, and later in life, not as fine. And so that's how I connected with CAT and the Stanford Institute, because I didn't want that to be the answer anymore. I do want kids. I want to have a future in a life outside of just me. And that's something that I asked Kat for advice on, and I really appreciated what you said at the time, is you said, it's not no, it's not yet. And so being at conversations like this one, where we talk about precision medicine, we talk about these incredible advancements in other ailments that people have suffered, I feel so optimistic for myself and for my future, because I know that there's this incredible group of minds all working on this incredible problem. So thank you very much.
Fantastic. So please take your seat. And that's why it matters. So we'll have everybody come up here that's given their little spiel, and we'll be able to have them grilled by all of you. So we really want to make sure that this is a meeting of the minds and you get an opportunity to ask questions, because, you know, whether it's the JAK2 mutation, nucleotide 1849 T to C, that may be corrected by base editing, just saying, Alexis, no pressure, that fuels a lot of these myeloproliferative neoplasms. I'm here just to guilt people into doing things. What's that? A little pressure, right? See, Alex and I are both ends. Yeah, we do have a meeting about this tomorrow. So this is a place... This is where we fix things. We don't just talk about problems, we fix them. So anyway, I don't have any questions because you can hear how erudite the panel is, but I think they need to hear from you with any questions you may have. So we have Mel as the first.
I'm aware of the sepsis work that you all are doing. So given that we're going to have data in Epic and we have access to bench to bedside, understanding patient priorities, where do you see potential low-hanging fruit for things that you could probably have some real impact very quickly with things like AI?
That may be for Dr. Longhurst.
Yes.
So thanks for the question, Mel. I think there's a lot of areas that are going to be low-hanging fruit. We're excited about diagnostic decision support to help clinicians make diagnoses faster and not miss things, you know, when they could be diagnosed. In a room full of people, typically 50% will raise their hands about having a family member or friend or loved one who's had a missed or delayed diagnosis. I think that's going to be one of the biggest impacts in healthcare. The next, you know, Kat and the panel have talked about a lot, which is using genomic information. And the reality is we've got some experts here who know how to do that, and then we have a lot of primary care physicians and others who don't. And so bringing that genomic information with appropriate decision support to the front line of care, I think, is going to be critical for helping improve outcomes.
And we can get Epic to comment on that as well.
Yes. I would agree with those comments, really. Leveraging deeper and broader data sets to drive precision diagnosis, and then with those diagnoses, really making the right treatment decisions easy without having to have a expert to kind of hardwire that into the protocol. It'll just be kind of defaulted at the right dose, the right frequency for your profile. I think those two things are true. On the patient experience, a lot of time is spent with authorizations too. I mean, we don't think of AI as automating only clinical things, but we have a lot of work to help reduce the time to treatment so that information can flow and automated authorizations and things like that can help get you into care faster.
So I have a question for Alex, and everybody else can chime in. Having worked with Illumina, did you have your genome sequenced and did you submit that in this process? And would you recommend everybody who has had it submitted to their medical records?
That's a great question. At the time that I started at Illumina, we didn't offer that, but I think in my last year, we started to. During the course of the program, I think at the time it was 50% covered, which meant it was $5,000. So I opted not to. I don't know if that benefit has changed. I'm sure it has. They were really trying to drop the cost. But I've had some NGS done. Kat can kind of speak to that more than I can. But yeah, every other year.
Twice a year.
Okay.
Than you think.
Kat has an entire warehouse of data on me. I just want you guys to know it's a secret.
Yeah, it's HIPAA compliant. Chris, at the back.
Would you recommend people submitting their genomic sequence to their care providers?
Oh, that's an interesting one.
So this is a very interesting one. And I guess what I'd say at a very high level is that sharing with your care provider, I think, is a safe and reasonable approach. And we've got HIPAA compliant, you know, mechanisms for storing that data, reanalyzing it, et cetera. As you know, there's a lot of consumer genetic testing that doesn't come with those same safeguards. So whether it's, you know, direct from Illumina or platforms that use Illumina, I think that there's more question about that than there are answers. This idea of sort of everybody getting whole genome sequencing, I think, is going to evolve with time. And, you know, it's very similar to this idea of should you get a whole body scan? Mm-hmm. Well, there are things you can find, and a lot of them end up, you know, chasing you down rabbit holes that aren't helpful for care. So if you've got clear symptoms, I think whole genome testing is absolutely going to be helpful. But I'm not sure we're at a point where we're ready to do that for the population.
But we do want to start an Uber concierge, Stellar Health, to do that with Chris and the team. So another Chris, my sister.
Yeah, this is
Chris Jameson.
I just came back from a conference and, you know, 2/3 of the talk were on single cell analysis. So the next technologies that are coming down are single cell analysis or cell-free DNA analysis, methylation. How soon do you think those could be implemented into EPIC?
Joe.
Well, I think that, you know, as we get more and more information of what is going to be the standard of care, that will drive much of our development efforts. I think one of the things that we see is we don't want people having to do these protocols one-off, bespoke, and kind of make it up as they go. And so as we see that standard of care evolve, I think you'll see more and more of that just be out of the box and standard for all. In the meantime, we'd work with each organization to make sure the pathways that you see as the best care pathways are built out for clinicians to take advantage of. So that'd be my answer.
I want to put Joel on the spot a little bit here. Because Alex and I have talked about this before. What if we had, you know, physicians have access to Cosmos and the data, researchers who are HIPAA compliant have access. Could we have a patient like me portal on EPIC so that we could see our genome? So we're all going to be patients, so nobody should feel stigmatized, but we could see our genomic sequence in the context of other people. So when you have rare diseases like myeloproliferative neoplasms that affect 5 per 100,000 people, that's a yearly diagnosis rate. How do you know what other people are doing and what they look like? What does Cosmos do there?
Yeah, I think for rare disease, there's an initiative right now to help patients connect with providers where, you know, maybe within one health system, they've only seen an N of one, but we can scan out to find different provider groups who have seen that condition more often and then connect the docs and make that kind of virtual consult across the community. I do think, though, that there is more for patients to consume directly through MyChart. And our first step is to connect rare disease patients with providers. And as we get more and more kind of standard data and definitions, we feel comfortable about what that means to not worry patients, but kind of make it a trusted piece of information in MyChart. There's opportunity there for sure.